From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The resurgence of white supremacist groups in Donald Trump's America has left many Americans scared and worried, particularly those among communities that the racist organizations target. We hear such pronouncements that extreme racism is, quote, un-American. Sadly, of course, racism has been built into the fabric of the United States from its inception. And no organization better captures that sentiment than the Ku Klux Klan, a group that has surged and waned repeatedly over the past 100 years, first emerging in the 1860s and 70s, then again in the 1920s and 30s, and for the third time in the 1950s and 60s. A new book explores in great detail the second wave of the KKK in the 1920s, with historical lessons that can inform our present. It's called The Second Coming of the KKK, and its author Linda Gordon now joins me. She is the winner of two Bancroft Prizes and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. She's the author of Dorothea Lange and Impounded, and the co-author of Feminism Unfinished. She teaches at New York University, and her book is entitled, her latest book that is entitled The Second Coming of the KKK, The Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and the American Political Tradition. Welcome to the program, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So why the second coming of the 1920s? Why did that become the focus of your book? How does that wave of resurgence in the 1920s compare with the earlier, the first emergence in the 1870s?
Well, you know, there are two things that make the 1920s Klan important. One is that very few people know about it, and their image of the Klan has to do with the first Klan. But the second is that the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s was a truly national phenomenon. It was also a mass phenomenon. It had somewhere between 4 and 5 million members, and that doesn't count all of the non-members who were probably very sympathetic with its bigotry. It also differed in a really important way. The first Klan, which was confined to the South, focused exclusively its hatred on African Americans, and it had one and only one purpose, and that was to reinforce white supremacy after the Civil War and to prevent African Americans from trying to access any political rights, civil rights, economic rights. And furthermore, this first Klan was extremely violent. Violence was its main method. And over time, it lynched more than 4,000 people.
So it was essentially a terrorist organization.
It was literally terrorist in the literal meaning of that term, right, meaning that its target was not just the individuals it lynched, but it was trying to send a message to intimidate the whole African-American population. The second Klan was primarily nonviolent, not exclusively, but primarily, and its major strategy was as a social movement and as an electoral force.
So the fact that this second coming was broader is, of course, a really important aspect of American society and American history. What was it about the political landscape at that time that generated this level of support for an organization with such a racist and terrorist reputation?
Let me start this way. The most important strategic decision that the Second Klan made was not to limit their hostility to African Americans. And that's partly because in the 1920s, there were still very few African Americans in the North. Instead, they expanded what you might call their hate list to include primarily Catholics and Jews. And the reason they did that was that they were responding to the very, very large-scale immigration that was coming into the United States, primarily starting in the 1880s. And that massive immigration consisted primarily of people who were not Protestants. You had Jews from Eastern Europe, Catholics from Southern Europe, Orthodox and Muslims from the Near East. And it was around that massive immigration that the Klan was able to create an absolute hysteria of fear that these immigrants, who it considered always aliens, were trying to take over America.
And of course, this was at a time when these immigrant groups, sort of before they became white, if you will, right?
Well, it's complicated. This was shifting in the 1920s, but it's certainly true that many Americans would not have considered Jews white, would not have considered Southern Italians white. In other words, the definition of whiteness was still in process. And in many ways, particularly the anti-Semitism. In fact, when you look closely at the Klan ideology, you will see that the anti-Semitism was actually closer to the anti-Black racism than it was to anti-Catholicism. The reason for that, just to explain that simply, is that if you were a Catholic, you could convert to Protestantism and then you would be fine. Then you would be a true American. But Jews and people of color, and by that I mean not only Blacks, but also Mexican Americans in the West, Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, these were people who, in the view of the Klan, were in their essence incapable of being true Americans.
You write in your book that there were some very specific incidents that sort of sparked the second coming of the KKK. There were, in fact, two of the incidents were media events, and the other was a lynching. Can you tell us that story?
Well, probably the major media event, and one that I think many people know about, is the premiere of the film Birth of a Nation in 1915. This is a famous film in part because it was a pretty sophisticated early use of film technology, but it was one of the most terrifyingly racist set of images that you could possibly imagine. It purported to show huge hordes of African Americans who were depicted as absolute savages and whose purpose was simply massively to rape white women. And this is important because the accusations of rape, which were almost never true, was what the justifications were for the Southern lynching. But Birth of the Nation exploded into popularity in the North as well, even to the extent that President Woodrow Wilson showed it in the White House, praised it. And that's very significant because it suggests that even someone like Wilson, who was not a member of the Klan and probably thought the Klan was a bit too hysterical for him, he nevertheless shared the racial ideology of the Klan.
Let's talk about some of the leaders of the second Klan and this idea of Americanism, which you alluded to earlier, that a Catholic could convert to Protestant to be a Protestant and be American. Tell us about Hiram Evans and his ideas.
Well, the founder of the second Klan was a guy called William Simmons, and William Simmons was pretty much an incompetent. But he did one very astute thing and also a pioneering thing. He hired a PR firm. And to the best of my knowledge, that is the first time that any social movement hired a PR firm. And this PR firm came up with a strategy that was largely responsible for building the Klan that Hiram Evans inherited. Their strategy was essentially a pyramid scheme. If you recruited someone to the Klan, they had to pay a $10 initiation fee. That was a lot of money in those days. That is worth more than $100 today. This was not an organization of poor people. But if you recruited someone, you got to keep 40% of that initiation fee. The person you recruited could then go and recruit someone else and keep 40% of that. And that kept going. But eventually, like as in all pyramid schemes, you get to a place where there really are no more people to recruit. And that created a lot of resentment. When Hiram Evans kind of unseated was Simmons from the head of the organization. He actually was aware that was always a lot of resentment of that kind of way of making it a profit-making operation. And he ended that. But he had already inherited a major, huge organization. And his creation was to turn it into a powerful electoral force.
Right. And that's a huge part of the story. So the second version, the second coming of the Klan, was spread throughout the country and not relegated to the South. This is critical. I mean, in doing some research for your book, I was looking up some images, and you see these images of thousands upon thousands of white hooded Klansmen in places like New Jersey and even Los Angeles, you can find, or near Los Angeles at least. So this is a history that seems to be obscured, because even today when Americans think of the KKK, we think of it as being a sort of Southern phenomenon, right?
Right. No, this is extraordinarily important. And in fact, the case I singled out in the book is the case of Oregon. I chose Oregon because it happens to be my home state, but I also chose it because here you have a state that had almost no African Americans, the tiniest percentage of Catholics and Jews, and nevertheless, the Klan was able to rev up this real hysteria that these un-American types were trying to take over power in that state. And that in turn raised for me questions that I think many people puzzle about today. And that is that how could you get so many hundreds of thousands, millions of people to believe claims that were so completely outrageous and so completely without any evidence?
So the ways in which the Klansmen recruited one another, recruited new members, I understand eventually turned into these very mainstream, large-scale events. Let's talk about that, because that's also an important aspect of the story, that you didn't just have to be somebody wearing a white hood and pay dues to be, in a way, part of this movement, right? I mean, this group and its various chapters were able to recruit huge numbers of Americans by sponsoring church houses and community centers and throwing big carnivals. Tell us about that, the ads that they took out to attract people to come to their big outdoor carnivals.
Right. You know, if the financial arrangements were one source of its rise, it had a very sophisticated notion of using public spectacles in many ways. And the public spectacles had two edges. One edge were the marches of the people in these robes who were designed to frighten and intimidate. But the other was to try to use these apparently very benign mass pageants and picnics, very much like traditional American county fairs, but much, much larger. And they had fireworks, and they had games, and they had contests, and they had lots of food and so on, so that they actually surrounded their bigotry with this notion that this was really just a positive community expression of the white Protestant people, of course.
So while the Klan of the 1870s had sought to terrorize, use violence as a tool, and engaged in public spectacle that actually involved killing and lynching, what was the goal of the manifestation of the bigotry of the second Klan?
The same Klan, essentially, though they never said it so exactly, but they wanted to disfranchise anyone who was not a white native-born Protestant. They did several things, and you know, they made a lot of specific, concrete successes in terms of legislation and electing candidates. But I think their major success, and the one that reverberates so much with what we see today, was that they succeeded in making these kind of expressions of bigotry, making them seem respectable, legitimating them. And you know, this of course, it is true that bigotry is an old American tradition. It is often underground, periodically it rises to the surface. But I think there's a real difference between when it is underground or people whisper their racism quietly to each other, a difference between that and when they are shouting it from the rooftops, because the latter is really much more dangerous, because it is trying to say that this is a respectable point of view, and even from the Klan's point of view, that this is compatible with democracy.
Right. And so their racial politics were clear, but what about their class politics? Because then that feeds into how they entered the political system. Who did the Klansmen consist of?
Well, you know, we don't have exact evidence. We just have some anecdotal evidence, because we don't have many membership lists. But we do know that the Klan was not an organization of the very poor. It was not even primarily an organization of working class people, although there were certainly plenty of working class people in it. It was primarily what you would call a lower middle class, and occasionally even professional class people. And, you know, this is one of the reasons that I am very, very critical of the current tendency to label movements like the Klan populist. Because, you know, we had a populist party in the 1890s, and that was a really progressive political formation that tried to support reforms that would benefit what we might today call the 99%, the urban and rural working class and lower middle class people. The Klan had nothing to offer those people. It had not the slightest interest in any reform that could have helped middle class and working class people. And in fact, the Ku Klux Klan honored the very rich, respected them, consistently tried to draw them into leadership positions in the Klan. So in many ways, that whole notion of populism is very misleading.
How normalized did the Klan become in the 20s and 30s? And I definitely want to talk about sort of what was it that marked the end of the second wave, but at its peak, at its heyday, how normalized was it in terms of sort of newspaper coverage and the way in which ordinary Americans accepted it?
It was completely respectable and legitimated. The Klan had over 150 newspapers. It had two radio stations. It had a recording company producing.
A recording company. Wow.
Yes, indeed. It even tried to create a film company, because one of its huge enemies was Hollywood, which it considered a Jewish conspiracy to undermine the morals of America. But I think what you really see is two things about this respectability. For example, in a number of states, people who were opponents of the Klan passed resolutions that prohibited people from marching with the masks so that you could not see their faces. But that those laws, instead of reducing the popularity of the Klan, simply added to its popularity. Similarly, the Klan ran many, many political candidates who ran openly as Klanspeople and were elected to office. The Ku Klux Klan was a registered fraternity at many universities, including the University of Wisconsin, which many people think of as a very liberal university. Many of these people would simply have defended their membership by saying, "This is just another fraternal order, and we are standing up for our people," our right. people being white Protestants.
And so many of these, of course, are these sort of threads of logic sound familiar today when we hear about white supremacist groups simply wanting their free speech rights and using the sort of language is attempting to normalize them. So we talked earlier about this, the spreading of this myth of the rape of white women by black men as a reason why the KKK helped recruit members. In the end, it was the rape of a white woman that ended the second coming of the Klan, but not by a black man, right?
Yes, but I think you can exaggerate how important that one okay. episode was, because the Klan was already having a lot of trouble and many members were resigning and it was losing strength. But it is true that that case, which is a really horrifying case that involved the Grand Dragon of Indiana, who kidnapped, raped, tortured, and then murdered a woman who worked for him. And that was such a sensational case that it was press covered it all over the country. And it probably was, for some Klan's people, the last straw. But what's more important is that that is probably the only case that I found where a member of the 1920s Klan was ever convicted of a crime. Because even though I said that the Klan was mainly nonviolent, it was not exclusively nonviolent. It was constantly attacking, particularly because they were staunch defenders of prohibition. They attacked saloons, they attacked people who made homebrew, etc. But it is true that I wish I could say that the Klan declined, because there was a very large ground-up protest movement against it. Unfortunately, that was not the case. The Klan really declined because of its own internal problems. But even though it declined, it had created some really lasting, severe damages to at least what I think of as the as American democracy. Probably the worst one was the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act. Before 1924, the federal government had no restrictions on immigration. But that restriction act did not simply restrict the overall numbers of immigrants. Instead, it installed a set of quotas, giving large quotas to the people it considered desirable, and very low quotas to those it considered undesirable. And that hierarchy of the values of different groups was identical with the Ku Klux Klan's hierarchy of the superior and the inferior people. And I think we need also to keep in mind, just one more point on this, that that immigration law was in effect until 1965. For 40 years, the American system of immigration control was based on this completely racist and bigoted hierarchy of who was desirable and who was not.
Again, so many lessons for today when we hear these claims that immigration restrictions are simply about creating legal ways into the country and waiting one's turn. There is a white supremacist history of immigration exclusion, particularly of certain immigrant communities, that is particularly relevant today, given who is in the White House and who supports them. So that was the second coming of the KKK. There was a third resurgence in the 60s around the civil rights movement. Do you view what we are seeing today as a fourth resurgence, given the history that you've studied?
I do, although I actually think that it is important not to think of it strictly as the organization, the Ku Klux Klan, because today the Ku Klux Klan is a very small, decentralized set of groups that are only one small part of this very frightening rise of white nationalism. It is a very different movement today. It is not centralized into one large organization. It is no longer anti-Catholic. That's a very important change, that Catholics, to some extent, became integrated into what many white Christian Americans see as proper Americans, but the anti-Semitism remains, the hostility to African Americans remains, but also a renewed set of hostilities to immigrants from all over the world. And of course, the irony of this racism, or maybe it's not irony, maybe it's part of the racism, is that some of the people who are the most in need, some of the refugees who are suffering the most, are the people that this new alt-right or white nationalists are going after.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Linda, for joining us today and spending this time with us discussing your new book. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Gordon is the winner of 2 Bancroft Prizes and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. She's the author of Dorothea Lange and Impounded and the co-author of Feminism Unfinished. She teaches at New York University. We've been discussing her new book, The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s and the American Political Tradition. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.